If you are a regular listener to the MP3 recordings of our Sunday sermons, then you may want to know that the message you are about to hear has been recorded in my office and not before a live audience in a worship service. The reason is pretty simple. The original March 4th recording, which was an introduction to the series on the Epistle of Jude, was basically unpresentable due to the loss of my voice because of a bad cold. The raspy, weak, froggy voice was extremely distracting. After reviewing about 20 seconds of that recording, I quickly decided to trash the whole thing and start over once my voice recovered, or at least partially recovered. And so with this new recording, I will not even try to pretend that I am behind a pulpit on a Sunday morning. I'm here in my office late on a Wednesday night reading from the original text that I had prepared. Hopefully, there won't be any disruptions or unwanted background noises like my phone ringing or a dog barking. So with that said, let's now get started. After we finished up the series on Ephesians a little over a year ago, I was on the lookout for our next book of the Bible to work through on a Sunday morning. However, I also had a growing list of topical studies that I was eager to get into, some of which we have since covered. One would be the Decision-Making and Will of God series, another on sanctification, another on helping the needy, and of course a short one on genocide in the Old Testament. But there are a few others that I have been wanting to jump into, especially since they have been on the back burner for some time now. And there are three in particular, and they all deal with subjects that are currently controversial in many Christian circles in one way or another. For about 3 years now, I've been wanting to do a series on eternal punishment, something Rob Bell and other emergent church leaders have been attacking rather openly. Is there a hell? And is it everlasting? And if so, why? I've also had my radar on a series on homosexuality, which is long overdue. I addressed this briefly many years ago, but so much more now needs to be said about it that I'm eager to address it. Given the fast and radical changes in our culture about homosexuality, it is something we as believers have to both think and act rightly about. And also a new controversy that has recently emerged due to the science of genome sequencing is the historicity of Adam and Eve. Scientists, even a number of scientists who are Christians, are claiming that the evidence from something called junk DNA now shows that human ancestry can be traced back to thousands of parents instead of just two. The findings, of course, reinforce this theory that humans emerged from primate ancestors and that Adam, in the book of Genesis, is basically a symbolic figure and not a real person after all. And so these three sermon series have been clawing at my screen door, so to speak, eager to get attention. Well, about a year ago, when I was reading through the Epistle of Jude in my normal daily Bible reading, I noticed that those three hot topics, eternal hell, homosexuality, and the historicity of Adam, were all there in that short letter. Now, they are not major themes. In fact, Jude basically just mentions them in passing, but nonetheless, I saw that Jude could provide a springboard into those topics. The other advantage, and this is a huge one, was the fact that Jude is, of course, a short book, just one chapter, a mere 25 verses. And I had already decided that my next book of the Bible for Sunday mornings would be something short, something more manageable, something that wouldn't take 2 or 3 years to work through. Plus, in previous studies, James, Hebrews, Ephesians, you know, by the time we get to the fourth or fifth chapter of the book, you know, when we're months into it, I had to keep reminding everyone of something the author said way back at the beginning in order to tie all of his thoughts together. Because obviously the longer the book, the greater the challenge to follow the author's complete train of thought and connect all the dots. So it all came together for me rather quickly about a year ago, and if you will remember, I even announced it on a Sunday morning that Jude was in the works and would be coming soon. At that point, I began to read it quite a bit from a variety of different translations and versions and found myself quite fascinated with its contents. The language is very vivid and colorful and is quite different than any of the other books of the New Testament. And so for the past year now, as I have anticipated teaching this series, I've actually enjoyed the research. Usually, I read from commentaries because it is what a person has to do to responsibly prepare for a sermon. But with Jude, well, actually, the commentaries have been more like recreational reading for me. It's actually been quite fun. I've enjoyed the things I've learned, and I have been looking forward to sharing them with you. In fact, I've been excited all week, and I'm really looking forward to this opportunity to talk about it. On the other hand, the book is a bit intimidating. There is a reason you seldom, if ever, hear sermons from Jude, much less a verse-by-verse study. It contains a number of oddities and difficulties that make it quite challenging. It is not the type of book that you can just read in a home group and go around the circle asking everyone to offer up their own thoughts. It is a minefield. It really is, filled with potential explosives. It has required far more work and research than I had originally imagined. It really has. And the more I have dug into it, I must admit that the more intimidated I have become by it. Simply put, deciding to tackle the Epistle of Jude for a Sunday morning series was actually quite a bit ambitious. Let me lay out some of the more obvious oddities and challenges. The first one is this. Jude quotes a prophecy from Enoch. Well, where did Jude get this prophecy? As we will see, there was a popular read in Jude's day, especially in Jewish circles, called the Book of Enoch, which contains this prophecy word for word. And so where did this book come from? I mean, did Enoch actually write it? Why is it not included in the Bible? Furthermore, Jude quotes this ancient prophecy as though it is an actual prophecy of God himself, that it's inspired, reliable, and authoritative. And he is clear to identify Enoch as that Enoch that we all know about, the one who is the seventh from Adam, the Enoch who walked with God and was taken into heaven. Did Enoch really prophesy this? And so there's a lot here that needs to be sorted out. A second oddity is this. Jude also talks about an argument between Michael, the archangel, and the devil. Again, something we don't have any information about in the Old Testament. Yet Jude speaks of it as something that actually happened. And so where did he get this? Well, it appears that the story came from another book that was popular during Jude's time. A book where only fragments of it have survived to our day, something called the Testament of Moses. And so there are all sorts of issues here, not just the reliability of the source, but the story itself of the devil and Michael arguing over the body of Moses. Is this some sort of parable, a popular fictional story? Jude certainly doesn't set it up that way. The whole thing really is kind of puzzling. What exactly would these two celestial beings be arguing about regarding the burial of Moses? And what difference would it make one way or the other on where he was buried? What are we to make of this? Number three, another problem also found in that passage is this warning to not blaspheme or slander celestial beings in verse 8. And Jude illustrates this with the fact that Michael refuses to blaspheme even the devil himself. And the implication is that we, therefore, should be careful about what we say so as not to insult Satan or show him any disrespect. But that seems rather odd to me. Is it even possible to slander or blaspheme the devil? If slander means to say something bad about another, well, anything we would say about the one who is the epitome of badness, the embodiment of all that is bad, well, it would be bad. To speak truthfully is to speak ill of the devil. In fact, we find the New Testament filled with derogatory statements about the devil. And so, what is really going on here? Am I never to refer to the devil as evil, or a liar, or a thief? He is, of course, all of those things and more. So, what's really going on here in this passage? Number four, if those situations in the book aren't enough to give me pause, the one in verses 6 and 7 certainly are. Here, Jude condemns the sexual sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, and in so doing, he casts it alongside the sin of angels from long ago who abandoned their proper domains. He compares the two, indicating that both indulged in sexual immorality and both were guilty of pursuing strange flesh, unnatural desires. Well, all of this, of course, takes us back to an obscure passage, a quite controversial passage in Genesis 6, where some read into it that angels left their abode in heaven, came to earth, united sexually with human women, and these women then produced an offspring of giants. At first, I thought verses 6 and 7 here in Jude would have an easy explanation that would allow me to quickly dismiss such nonsense. But that hasn't exactly been the case, though I am still working toward that end. To complicate things further, on kind of a side note here, this book of Enoch that I spoke of earlier is preoccupied with this very subject. It tells the whole story of how 200 angels left heaven so that they could unite with these human women, and how these angels taught humans all sorts of evil practices like witchcraft and sorcery and astrology, for instance, and how to perfect warfare using swords and other weapons of metal, and even introduced the whole art of cosmetics, everything from war paint to women using makeup. It's all there. It goes on to explain that this race of giants, the offspring who were half angel and half human, the Nephilim, that their souls upon their deaths became the demons and evil spirits that have and continue to possess victims through the centuries and plague the world. Well, it's all very bizarre. In fact, I bought a copy of the Book of Enoch. I was not only curious, but because Jude seems to rely on it, I thought I should become familiar with it myself firsthand. However, I made the mistake of reading it in bed before going to sleep, not something I would recommend. You could only imagine the dreams that I had on those nights, and actually am still having. Well, the deeper I looked into all of these things, about angels having sex with humans and the offspring of giants in the Book of Enoch, the weirder it became, and the more it looked like Jude himself was signing on to this weirdness, or at least some of it. And so, unable to find a satisfying way to refute this weirdness, I was actually struggling with a case of buyer's remorse. Buyer's remorse. But by that time, it was too late. I mean, I had already announced that Jude was in the works, but there were certainly times, I have to admit to you, that I was second-guessing the wisdom of this decision. What have I gotten myself into? Now, I must share with you that there was a day when the weird and bizarre fascinated me, but not so much anymore, especially in regards to theology, because these days I like my theology very straight, like a geometry lesson. I want it all to make sense and to figure out quite nice and clean and tight. But there is more here, a fifth oddity. On top of all this, we have the so-called curious problem that much of Jude's letter is repeated verbatim in 2 Peter. And so why is that? What's the relationship between these two books? Who copied who? And where there are differences, why are there differences? Well, the thought of tackling this question also seemed to be quite ambitious, not something I was looking forward to do. But I must say that doesn't really scare me too much anymore. Virtually all scholars believe Jude was written first, and so this question is more of one that pertains to the study of 2 Peter. You know, why did Peter copy from Jude? Which means I don't have to address it until we do a study of 2 Peter. And you can only guess when that might be. A long, long, long time, if ever. Number 6. Another thing that I find a bit strange is the solution Jude offers up to the problem that he has presented. This isn't something I found in any of the commentaries raising, but and so I might be alone here, but it is a bit unsettling to me. Jude spends most of his letter railing against these false teachers who have wormed their way into this particular church. He exposes their wicked intentions, warning them of the destruction they will bring. He is quite harsh in his assessment of them. And I would have expected some sort of run them out of town with pitchforks kind of response. You know, throw them out of the church. Don't even bother with all the steps listed in Matthew 18. Just throw them out right away. And while that could still be the right response, or a right response, the instructions in this letter are directed specifically toward making sure that the faithful remain steadfast. He exhorts them to be mature and stable, to persevere, and to remain strong in the Lord. And the application here at the end of the letter, though certainly appropriate, doesn't quite seem to fit the mood of the complaint. Well, at least to me. and perhaps by the time we get to those verses, I may not feel quite the same way. And seven, finally, Jude's letter is a bit quirky, or should I say different, in the way that he utilizes typology. I'll explain this more when we get into those sections, but basically, you have something in the past, someone like Cain, for instance, or the residents of Sodom and Gomorrah, serving as a foreshadow or type of these false teachers that Jude goes after. And so there is more here than just using types. He uses types as prophecy of the end times, of which he applies even to his own day. Jude does this sort of thing all through the letter. It's a method that is fairly unique to him, and so it takes a little getting used to. Again, events in the Old Testament history are seen to foreshadow and thus prophesy about events in the end times, of which Jude then applies to these false teachers in his own day. And so, though I was initially excited about teaching this book and ready to accept the challenges, I will have to admit that given its strange and terrible words, there were times I wished I had announced Philemon or 3 John instead. Now, some of these peculiar things in Jude just don't have easy and clean answers to. And in some ways, I actually think that the book of Ezekiel could be easier to work through verse by verse. Because this book contains a number of these oddities and difficulties, each of which are like minefields, because, you know, you could easily come to wrong and dangerous conclusions about some things here. And the picture of accidentally stepping on something and causing an explosion is somewhat accurate. I will be taking a very careful and conservative approach, which means that I will be relying heavily on the experts, Bible scholars who have devoted a lot of their time and energy in working through this book, including its oddities and difficulties and, yes, weirdness. I'm not going to step out on a limb ever, offering anything new or novel to the discussion. When I see several or all of the experts agreeing on something, well, I'm going with it. If they aren't in agreement, then I'll present the various opinions and lay out, of course, all the pros and cons. I am not a trained Bible scholar. I do not have a command of the original languages. This book is rooted in Jewish apocalyptic literature of the ancient world, of which I am, for the most part, unfamiliar with. And so any exegesis I might provide on any of the 25 verses of this book will be certainly carefully checked out by responsible commentaries. And this is one of the reasons I have on the outline, which you can find here on the website, if you're listening from the website, is listed where I've listed the resources that I will be relying on. And so for the most part, my role in this is to read and study the text, size up my own understanding with what the experts say, process the whole thing, and present it to you in a way that I hope is understandable, sound, organized, not too technical, makes sense, and most of all, is faithful to the truth. A common formula that I will probably utilize every week will be something along this line. You might think of this as a template. 1, here is what we know. 2, here is what we think we know. Things we can safely assume, things that make sense and fit in with what we know. And 3, here is what we don't know. And there will be a lot in Jude where we will have to be content to say, we just don't know. One more thing in regards to the way I plan to present the material. This series will consist of 2 major parts. We might think of it as Volume 1 and Volume 2. In Part 1, the plan is to simply work through the book verse by verse, highlighting Jude's main points, following his train of thought, and seeing how everything fits together. This, of course, is what we call biblical exegesis. The goal is simply to understand what Jude writes. In Part 2, after we have worked through the whole letter, I will then look at some of the topics that are mentioned in Jude's letter. We will have a series on eternal punishment. We'll have another series on homosexuality and some teaching on the historicity of Adam. And somewhere in all of this, either while we're working through the letter itself in Part 1 or later on in Part 2, I want to make sure that we spend some time covering things like sexual purity, boasting and flattery, restoration of believers who stumble, the keeping power of God, and the finality of God's revelation, that the scriptures are sufficient for living godly lives before the Lord, and no further revelation of truth can be added to this gospel that has once for all been delivered to the saints. All of these, of course, are topics that Jude raises. And we will also need to talk about antinomianism, which is a dominant problem in the letter. Jude addresses this, the idea that because Christians are free in Christ, they are not bound by the moral law of God, something that all of us have run into one time or another. So today is kind of an introduction to the introduction. And before we actually dive into the background of the book, which we will do next week, you know, things like authorship and why it was written and to whom it was written and when and so on, all of which, of course, are important for properly understanding the letter itself. Now, let me today, at this point, share some various comments about this book from the experts that will help give us a feel of what lies before us in our study of Jude. Here's one from Thomas Manton in this commentary he wrote in the middle 1600s. He writes, "His letter, though brief, is weighty and has in it some magnificent utterances on standing firm for Jesus Christ in the face of apostasy and immorality within the churches. It is not a letter to be overlooked." This one from Peter Davids. "Jude is a book that has often been treated with benign neglect, rarely the text for a sermon. Even in the university or seminary classroom, it is often given only brief treatment at the end of a course on general epistles, perhaps as part of the last lecture on the final day of the course." Edward Blum. "The book of Jude has been called the most neglected book in the New Testament. There may be various reasons for its neglect, such as its brevity, its citation of non-canonical Jewish writings, and its burning denunciation of error. Yet Christians and the church today need to listen to Jude's contribution to biblical revelation. The emphasis on a fixed core of truth, known as the faith, needs to be pondered." And this from Donald Guthrie. "Perhaps more than any other New Testament book, the Epistle of Jude is assumed to have little or no permanent value and is, therefore, virtually excluded from the practical, as distinct from the formal, canon of many sections of the church." In other words, he's just saying that the church, for the most part, just simply doesn't really use Jude. So it dismisses it, even though it's part of the formal, acknowledged canon. And then Guthrie continues, "If the examples Jude cites for his own day, Israelites, Sodom and Gomorrah, Cain, Balaam, Korah, had relevance then, his whole epistle must have relevance now, unless the nature of divine justice and the character of human lasciviousness and kindred evils has changed. As long as men need stern rebukes for their practices, the epistle of Jude will remain relevant. Its neglect reflects more the superficiality of the generation that neglects it than the irrelevance of its burning message." And now D.A. Carson. "This little letter is a strong challenge to its readers to oppose resolutely all teachings and habits of life that profess to be Christian but deny the essence of the faith. The letter speaks to the modern world as to every previous age. In our century, it is the fashion to be tolerant of anything that calls itself Christian. Jude reminds us that there are limits. The modern church must realize that it is possible to refashion the gospel so radically that the heart of it is taken out of it. It is possible to reinterpret the Christian life so that it ceases to be too demanding and degenerates into a way of living indistinguishable from that of the world. In the face of such attitudes, Jude's warnings are of continuing significance." And now this from Richard Bauckham. "The style is lively and vigorous, and the whole work gives evidence of careful composition. Close exegesis soon reveals great economy of expression. Single words, phrases, and images are chosen for the association they carry, and scriptural allusions and catchword connections increase the depth of the meaning." This from Stephen Krafcik. "The letter is filled with strange language and obscure references. It is polemical and uncompromising. and its author appears to satirize and disparage his opponents rather than engaging their thought and teaching. Well, that's true for sure. Moreover, the author's own words, or rather, moreover, the author's own thoughts are embedded in his polemic, and even a sympathetic reader must work hard at uncovering them. Leland Ryken. The author writes in the white heat of anger as he attacks his opponents more vehemently than anything else we find in the New Testament except for Jesus' denunciation of the Jewish leaders in Matthew 23. And then there is this, and I love the subtitle to this book here by Maxwell Coder, his commentary on Jude, which reads this way, Jude, the Acts of the Apostates. In fact, I was so impressed by that title that I bought the book just because of the title. Well, Coder offers these words in his introduction. Jude brings the teaching of the entire Bible about apostasy to a tremendous climax. He takes us back to the very dawn of human history. We are reminded of apostasy at the gate of Eden and within God's ancient people Israel. Our thoughts are turned to princes and prophets, to saints and sinners, to eternal fire and everlasting darkness, to the sea and to the stars, to past judgments and future glory. And he continues, we are taken into the unseen world for a strange and terrible story of the sin of fallen angels, and another story of a dispute between Michael the archangel and Satan, those antagonists who are set over against each other once more in mortal combat in Revelation 12. And a couple paragraphs later, he asks, why should such a rich storehouse of Bible truth have been so seriously neglected? All right, well, for the rest of our time here, I want us to get a feel for how the letter is structured. Now, your own Bible will probably show a structure similar to something like this. You have a greeting in the first couple verses, followed by a reason given for writing the letter, what we call the occasion. Then we have a section here on this warning against false teachers, which consists of the bulk of the letter. Then there's a short call to persevere toward the end, and of course the very popular doxology in the last two verses. This four-part outline that you see there in your Bible, if it's structured that way, and it probably is, it's easy to recognize. It's easy to see it from the text itself. It's pretty basic. It's also helpful. But we should know that there's more going on here to the structure than just these four blocks being tied together. We have something here we need to realize. Most people think that the focus of this letter is this big section, this denunciation against the false teachers, the largest block of material, which runs all the way from verse 5 to verse 19. And this, of course, would be a natural assumption that this is the most important part, given the fact that it occupies a good three-fourths of the book itself. However, when you take a closer look at this and actually follow Jude's train of thought, you see that this whole section here, this judgment against the false teachers, is simply background to the main point itself, which actually comes to us at verse 20. Jude is simply laying down the groundwork, and he's leading up to this real punch. Verses 20 to 23, that unit, the actual call to action, is where we find the actual purpose for Jude's writing. It is this appeal he makes to his readers to persevere in the faith and to remain strong in the Lord. Verses 20 to 23 are not, as many people tend to think, a closing exhortation. Rather, it is the climax to which everything else in the letter leads up to. Recognizing this, of course, is a vital key to the understanding of the work as a whole. So it's important that we keep this in mind. Verses 5 through 19, that large section, exists for the purpose of highlighting the importance of taking what he says in verses 20 to 23. So that said, let's now take a closer look at the structure of this denouncing false teacher section, verses 5 through 19. We find in it an interesting pattern which goes something like this. There is a citation of a historical event, something in the past that the readers would be familiar with. This then is followed with an explanation of how that event foreshadows the wicked and ungodly intentions of these false teachers. and this pattern is then repeated. And so a more detailed outline of this book would go something along this line. We begin with the greeting and purpose of the letter in verses 1 through 4. Then, starting in verse 5, we have the background to the appeal, this condemnation of false teachers. And this section then has five units inside it, five specific denunciations. Each one consists of a reference from history and then a fulfillment of that in these ungodly teachers. So, again, citation of a type and then the fulfillment of that type, and this functions as a prophecy. And again, this pattern is repeated for a total of five times. All of this then leads up to the appeal itself, verses 20 through 23, this call to persevere, and the letter concludes with the familiar doxology in verses 24 through 25. If you're following along on the handout, you'll see how this all fits together. One of the more noticeable stylistic characteristics that helps to highlight this pattern is Jude's repeated use of the formula, these people. The words these people or something similar are consistently used when making the transition from citing something in history to showing how that is fulfilled in the apostasy of the condemned teachers. So let's look at it now here firsthand, and you may want to follow along in the outline or in your own Bibles. Starting in verse 5, we have Jude referring to three different events in the Old Testament. Let me read it for you. Now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. There's one of them. The next one is this, in verse 6, and the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. And the third one then is in verse 7. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. And now the fulfillment or application in the very next verse, verse 8. Yet in like manner, these people also, relying on their dreams, defile the flesh, reject authority, and blaspheme the glorious ones. All right, there's the first of those five units. Let's start now with the second one, which begins in verse 9. There we find the second reference to something in the past, and it reads like this. But when the archangel Michael, contending with the devil, was disputing about the body of Moses, he did not presume to pronounce a blasphemous judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you," which is followed by how that applies to these teachers. But these people, that is in contrast to Michael, blaspheme all that they do not understand, and they are destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand indistinctively. All right, the third one then begins in verse 11. We have the citation of historical reference, in this case three Old Testament figures, each representing a particular aspect of ungodliness. Jude writes, "Woe to them, for they walked in the way of Cain," the first one, "and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error," number two, and then thirdly, "and perished in Korah's rebellion." And this, of course, follows the same pattern. It's followed by the fulfillment of that prophecy or type in the next verse. "These are hidden reefs at your love feast, as they feast with you without fear, shepherds feeding themselves, waterless clouds, swept along by winds, fruitless trees in late autumn, twice dead, uprooted, wild waves of the sea, casting up the foam of their own shame, wandering stars for whom the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved forever." Again, you know, strange and terrible words. All right, the fourth one, in verses 14 through 15, here we have the prophecy of Enoch against the ungodly. It was also about these that Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied, saying, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his holy ones to execute judgment on all and to convict all the ungodly of all their deeds of ungodliness that they have committed in such an ungodly way and of all the harsh things that ungodly sinners have spoken against him." And this prophecy will ultimately be fulfilled on the day of judgment, but is also fulfilled in the condemnation of these false teachers that Jude warns about. And we see that now in verse 16, that very next verse. These are grumblers, malcontents, following their own sinful desires. They are loudmouth boasters, showing favoritism to gain advantage. And now the last one, which begins in verse 17, the fifth unit here in this big section of the denunciations of these false teachers. Now you'll notice that most versions of the Bible, and a number of commentaries actually, begin the call to persevere here at verse 17. And the reason is because it certainly sounds like that is what Jude is doing. But when you look at this more closely, you see that these verses here actually continue on with the previous pattern that has been set out. You have a citation of a historical reference, which goes like this: "But you must remember, beloved, the predictions of the apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ. They said to you, in the last time there will be scoffers following their own ungodly passions." And then the fulfillment or application of that prediction to these troublemakers, these false teachers. As we continue to read, "It is these who cause divisions, worldly people, devoid of the Spirit." And notice the catchwords there, "it is these," which clearly ties these verses into that denunciation section. All right, so as we work through Jude, keeping this particular structure in mind, all this hopefully will prove to be helpful for you. And next time, we're actually going to spend some time on the who, what, when, where, and why, important background issues like authorship, place of writing, intended audience, date, purpose, and so on. And we might even dive into the whole matter of Jude's use of the apocryphal writings. We'll have to get into that sooner or later, and it might prove to be better just to, you know, get into it right away and take care of that. So let me encourage you to read the book of Jude through, at least before our next lesson on this. And I do want you to let you know that I do plan to use the ESV in this study. Before, I've always used the NIV, but I would recommend that you try to obtain a copy if you don't already have one. It's a free download for Kindle users. It's also free from the website Bible Gateway. I don't have a smartphone, but those who use smartphones tell me that it's also a free application on that too. So that concludes today's message, and hopefully this hasn't sounded too stifled recording this in my office. And hopefully you'll be able to follow up on the sessions that will follow, beginning with the next time as we deal with the background information.